Greetings, friend. Have you come seeking knowledge of a world that is shrouded in darkness and the untold horrors? A world where evil lurks around every corner, and only the bravest and most skilled warriors can hope to survive? Or perhaps you seek the refuge of the fireside and to be surrounded by humanity tonight. Perhaps a story to pass the time. I am Loder Ibn Lee, a keeper of the old tales. That one with the large array of weapons and deep, knowing gaze is known as Kairi. They are a stalwart and powerful companion, and will not harm you. That other one? Ah, yes. Faience. She is a necromancer of great power, and seeks to aid humanity in our darkest hour. We are the Lore Watch.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Lore Watch. If you didn't tell from the intro, we're going to be talking about Diablo 4 today because, I mean, it is in its early access. It officially releases at the time of this recording in about 25 hours, give or take, according to the countdown on their site. And we thought it would be a good time to actually talk about the story of the game. That said, there's going to be spoilers therein. So if you don't want the game spoiled for you, maybe skip this episode and come back later. It'll be here waiting for you. But on this journey, I am joined by not only the master barbarian himself, Matt Rossi, we have our special guest who is also super into Diablo, maybe possibly more than we are lately. And that's our editor-in-chief, Liz Harper, who has a... What are you maining in Diablo 4 right now? Is it the Necromancer?
It is indeed the Necromancer. I played the Necromancer more than any other class so far.
Yeah, and it's... I don't know about you, both of you, but I've been having a ton of fun. Like, to me, like, they've nailed the feeling of the classes, and I'm just having a great time, just even if I'm not actually doing anything, just running around the world and smashing things as a giant bear, because it is just fun.
It's satisfying to smash things.
Yes. Oh, I love it. But we're here to talk about that story beats. And Diablo 4 is an interesting beast in and of itself, because it is the first always on Diablo game. It is the first Diablo game that they have outwardly said that they plan to continue to release plot and story updates as the game progresses in longevity, which means what we have now is not necessarily the final story. It is, however, the first campaign of potentially many. So I think that's fascinating. And I don't know how you two feel about that. Do you think that is a good change, a bad change?
I mean, it's basically taking what they were doing in D3 and making it more natural. People forget they actually did introduce story in Diablo 3 after Reaper of Souls. It was just weird little story things that didn't have anything to do with anything. They were just like, you know, hey, let's jam in a new dungeon over here and we'll have a crazy cult over there and we'll have a crazy guy who's in charge of the cult. And it's like, okay. What does this have to do with anything? Nothing. Just, yeah, there it is. They're a cult. There's the story of that cult. And the creepy guy following you around is definitely an evil cultist who actually turns out to be a demon. Yeah. Don't worry about it. You're not going to see him again. Just classic. Kill him here and that's it.
Classic Diablo trope.
Yeah.
Liz, so how do you feel about it?
I think it's great. I think probably for the first time, this is a Diablo game that is really playing into the story. And what Sanctuary feels like, as opposed to just being an adventurer here to kill demons. And I know we were just talking about how fun it is to go in and like smash, smash, smash. But there's a lot more going on in the background. I don't think any other Diablo game has been like this before. What do y'all think?
Well, I was going to mention one of the things that caught me up my eye when I was doing my playthrough. I have a barbarian that I play with my wife, and I have a barbarian that I play when I'm by myself. So the one I'm playing by myself is further along, obviously. But I keep getting sidetracked. Like, every time I try really hard to just blaze through the story, but then I'm like, I'm in, Skazglen, and they end up at that keep with the goose, and it looks like it's going to be all funny hijinks. It looks like it's all going to be funny hijinks, and then you get told about a weird thing, and next thing you know, like, everything's on fire, and there's crazy people, and this guy's telling you about his life, and it's like, what? Oh, my Lord. This is way more in-depth and quite interesting. Like, I'd say there's almost several sub-themes running through Diablo 4, and one of them is that even really good people who want to do the right thing can lose something.
Mm-hmm.
Of themselves in the act of trying to do the right thing because of what it takes, the toll it takes on you. And mm-hmm. that whole idea of, you know, what are you willing to do? Like, are you willing to go, like, once you go to a certain place, once you start doing certain things, you have changed who you are and you can't just go back. And yeah, there's a lot of that in this. It's just, it's really fascinating. And unfortunately, all these subquests are really interesting, and you end up doing a lot of them, and then you still haven't finished the game. That's me. I'm still in Act 5.
Yeah, there's a that's the other thing about this as well, is like, there is the main story beats, but oh man, are there so many side quests and so many random things to go find and do. Like, you could be heading on your way to go to finish the Tarnished Luster questline, and then find like four little blue exclamation points along the way that lead you careening all across the map in Act 1. And before you know it, you've spent your entire time in Act 1 chasing down all these side quests and haven't even touched the main quest. But they're all so engrossing. There's so much story. And Liz talked about this on the main podcast, and I think it really is evident, is just how much the world feels like a world and not just a game setting, which I think is fascinating.
Liz, do you remember the guy with the eyes that you mentioned to me because I hadn't noticed him?
Oh, I do. I do that, remember the guy.
That whole thing.
The guy without the eyes, technically. Yes, yes.
Technically, he does not have his eyes anymore. They're still around. So he just doesn't have them.
Did you actually finish the quest?
I cleared out the stronghold.
Uh-huh. And did you go back to him after that?
No, because I was trying to get through the thing.
yeah. Well, let me just tell you, it's a lot of things like this where you just run into something. In this case, what Matt's talking about is you're in Kyovashad, which is the main town you start out in. And you go, there's a little area and there's a guy in stocks. And he is, he's complaining, obviously, and he has no eyes. He has no eyes because a witch stole them. And she does terrible things, and he sees them. He sees all of them. He sees all of the things she does because she wears his eyes as a necklace. And you go and investigate this, and you clear out a stronghold full of cultists, and then you go into a dungeon, and you kill the witch, and you retrieve his eyes, and you bring them back, and everything is fine, and it's a totally happy ending where everything works out.
You can't see me right now, but I'm giving her such side eyes.
Well, let's...
So far, that hasn't been my experience in any of the stuff I've finished. Like, for instance, the one where you investigate, like, why are there all these werewolves all of a sudden? And it's like, whoa, this went darker than I thought. And it's a werewolf quest, so I thought it was going to be dark, but it's way darker than I thought it was going to be. And, well, can we, like, let's, Joe, let's, you have the idea of talking about it.
Yeah, let's start from the very beginning, and let's start with the prologue. So the prologue, obviously, the very first thing you get into in the game is with the cinematic, with you losing your horse, you trying to find shelter and make your way through this blizzardish storm that's happening, and you find yourself coming into a town, and the town sort of welcomes you and then says, by the way, we have a problem. Can you go take care of this problem for us?
And Adventure Time, the way you do.
Yeah, like an Adventurer Time. So, like, you know, you think to yourself, okay, this is perfectly fine and normal. And you go, and it does. It starts out very normal where you go, and then you find the cave, you go into the cave, you beat up a bunch of fallen, you discover that there are new versions of fallen, some that explode, some that are just really, really big and hit very, very hard.
Those exploding ones are bad
news. They're get out of that. Super bad.
So bad.
And then you make your way back to the town like you would the triumphant hero once you've completed everything. And then,
hooray!
Liz, what happens when you get back to the town?
Well, they drug you into unconsciousness, and then they plan to sacrifice you to their new god, Lilith.
Yeah.
So you skipped the party, though.
There was a party.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that's my favorite part of the whole thing is when they like, come, stay, we have stew. And then, you know, you feel like rocking out with them, you know, waving your mug around. And then, yeah, boom.
They have to drug you somehow. They do it subtly. I mean,
they put the drug in the stew.
I assume so. Well, yeah. I figured
it was either the stew or in that mug you're constantly holding around.
But that's kind of one of the insidious things about Lilith going around Sanctuary is, you know, some of her followers seem like normal, reasonable people.
Well, and
like these people, it's like on the outside, it's like everything looks normal. It's just normal village.
That's the interesting thing, right? Because the whole presentation of this is sort of the dressing for the story. It's the setup. It's the appetizer course where it's like, this is kind of how the world works now. And it's interesting because as you're going through, you might notice that the cinematic you saw maybe a little bit earlier, maybe when you were looking at the reveal of the game, is actually, this is the town. So as you're dragged into unconsciousness and dragged over to be, well, let's just say the sausage, you don't want to know how it's made. but you're saved by a cleric, I guess. I don't know what he actually is, like a clergyman, something.
They keep saying monk.
A monk of the Cathedral of Light, Yosef, who was also drugged and left for dead, but woke up before they could do anything, and then is freeing you.
They probably, it's actually pretty ironic. They probably forgot to deal with him because you showed up and then they had to get rid of you.
Yeah, you showed up probably as they were dragging him off. Right.
All according to plan.
Then you go through and you bust your way out of the barn that you are in, and you have to beat up a couple of the crazed villagers to make your way through. And then you get led through into the center of the town. You find your way to the cathedral that has seen better days. The cinematic plays inside of the cathedral, which is the cinematic we've seen of Lilith coming to the people and basically enticing them to give way to their baser nature, to their true aspect of themselves, and give way to revelry through sin. And then you burn the town down. Because that's what you do when you're faced with cultists like that.
To be fair, I didn't burn it down. Yosef burned it down.
Fair, Yosef burned it down. Yeah.
To be extra fair, you burned down the church where Lilith arrived in, and the town is still there, and you can actually go back to it. There's even a waypoint there and some quests.
Yep. Isn't that where you'd find that crazy axe?
Yes, it is where you find the crazy axe.
Yeah.
The crazy axe. You find a crazy axe covered in blood, and you give it to a clergy person, and everything goes completely well. End of story.
Yeah.
It's fine. Everything's fine.
I don't know if you're just doing this on purpose or if you're deliberately, like, would you just leave after you do that kind of thing? Because the follow-up quest is almost always not that.
Sometimes if you get to the very end, it ends okay, but
the game does have a habit of...
The short version is you end it one quest earlier than you're supposed to. Everything is fine. Everybody is happy. Nothing goes wrong. And you just move on with your life is what I'm hearing. If you don't actually continue the quest after that, everything is sunshine.
It's interesting how it paints a very bleak world. And there's a lot of pain here. There's a lot of bad things that have happened to everyone. And a lot of personal stories of this, not just the overarching story.
Yeah.
But somehow, a lot of the times you go to the next quest, and it is worse. Mm-hmm. It is actually worse than you thought.
What's really weird, though, is that this game manages to not be, like, depressing.
Well, there's an undercurrent. Yeah, I agree. There's an undercurrent of hope through it, right?
Well, and I think the undercurrent of hope is literally just that you are so freaking stubborn. Like, you know, this person that you are playing just will not lay down and die. Like, the entire world that seems to be saying, yes, give up. And you're like, no.
But hold on. That's sort of the interesting thing about it, though, is, like, that's really not the story. Like, so that's the prologue. After the prologue, you make your way out of town and you wind up finding yourself at what looks like a abandoned lodge, although it's not really abandoned. You make your way in. you see that there's a bunch of viscera and skulls and stuff all around the place, and you think to yourself, you're spoiling for a fight. There's going to be something bad that happens here. The door then kicks open behind you, and in walks one of my favorite grumpy old men in the series. Lorath comes in, who just says, if you're going to break into my house and root through my stuff, at least stay for dinner. which I thought was a fantastic line.
Yes, but there is a thing about that. It's like, this moment comes right after you've eaten dinner with a bunch of crazy cultists who tried to murder you, and then you're like immediately invited to dinner again, and you're just like, yeah, cool. I think I'll have dinner with this crazy old man living in the woods.
I don't know if you've noticed, but good decision making. Not something that Hero of a Diablo game actually has.
What do I say about heroes in the video games that we play? They always make bad decisions. But
I don't even know if these are necessarily bad decisions, but I do want to talk about Lorath a little, because I think he's kind of endemic of... He embodies something I've really noticed about this game, is that when stuff from the previous game shows up, it's in a way that lets you feel how much time has actually passed.
Oh yeah! Like what is the quote that he had? I used to pretend to be a Herodric hero when I was a boy, fighting monsters with my wooden sword. That feels like so long ago now, or something like that.
Yeah, I just remember, like, if you played D3 Reaper of Souls, Lorath is in that, and he's voiced by Yuri Lowenthal, who's a fine voice actor. He voiced Spider-Man in these PS5 games. So yeah, perfectly good actor. But they didn't go with him for this one, and it makes perfect sense that they didn't, because this Lorath has been through it.
Well, and also consider that it's, what, 30 or 50 years after Reaper of Souls?
50 years. Years later.
He's old. He's very old.
Mm-hmm. He's 70 at the least. And man, we'll talk about it when we get to that act, but there's just an absolutely, I think, a perfect moment of him talking to the Wanderer, which is what your character ends up getting called this time around. There's just a perfect exchange between the two of them that I want to bring up, but I really do like Lorath's character. I was like a little upset, as my wife pointed out, it kind of sad that we won't have Deckard Cain. But in a way, Deckard Cain is a character in this game, even though he doesn't appear. At least he hasn't up to the point I've played in, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't.
He's a legend, right? Like, he's a legend that has helped to form the story of the world.
Yeah, well, and you can tell that his role, Lorath never even met him. Lorath never met Deckard Cain. Deckard was dead before Lorath even joined the Herodrum. And yet, you can tell that Deckard's influence is all over the Herodrum. So yeah, we should probably get to talking about...
Well, I want to hear what Liz has to say.
Go ahead, Liz.
At one point later in the game, you've seen this already, I know, Matt. Laura says, I wonder what old Deckard Cain would say about all this. How would he look at the story? He's still way up there in people's minds.
Yeah, and you know, in a weird sort of way, the first narrator of the game before Lorath starts up, I'm pretty sure it's Elias, but I'm not 100% on that. But I kept redoing his dialogue as Deckard Cain, and it was more fun for me.
I think the interesting thing, though, is like, because Deckard Cain was always presented in the previous games as a hero of the people in a lot of ways. Maybe not necessarily a hero, but on the side of humanity. Like, he would travel. Man of the people. He would travel. He would share the stories. He would, you know, give tales of hope and bravery, as well as being a keeper of like the old lore. So like, he had a lasting effect on those that are struggling to survive. And I think it's also very telling, because as you start making your way from the epilogue to Act One, and start making your way through Act One, which we'll break into here in a moment, you really feel how much those stories have maybe informed survival for humanity. Because that I think is one of the more interesting things. People know how to fight the monsters because people like Deckard Cain shared stories on how to fight the monsters, right? It's not necessarily, you know, just, you know, join the army and go forth and do the thing. But here's the weakness for these creatures. It's like, the best way I can frame it for anybody who's not familiar with Diablo series in general is like, he's the Bobby in Supernatural to like the world here. He knows all the lore. Like, that's his job, right? Like, his job is to figure out how things happen, how things work, share the stories, and keep the oral tradition alive so humanity can keep pressing forward. And that's interesting, because you think of the Herodrum as like these huge, like, stoic figures of myth and legend that fought the devils. And yeah, they did. But they also gave, like in Deckard Cain's part, a lasting legacy for humanity's survival through the act of storytelling, which is just phenomenal. But let's break into the first act here. So sorry, go ahead.
I do want to cut in. Do we want to talk about Rathma's prophecy? Because that actually
comes
up right there in the beginning, even though
that's a good point.
They tell you that in the prologue, though you don't exactly know what it means yet.
Yeah, you know what? Do you want to read it off, or do you want me to do it?
I can read it off. I don't have your dramatic announcer voice, but I'll do my best.
Go for it.
So it really, really early in the game, you have no idea what's going on, but you get this prophecy while you're being dragged by Lilith's cultists off to be slaughtered, apparently. And it goes like this. I saw my corpse and from my mouth crawled hatred. A father burned his children on a pyre. And a mother molded a new age from the ashes. I saw the weak made strong, a pack of lambs feasting on wolves. Tears of blood rained on a desert jewel, and the way to hell was torn asunder. Then came a spear of light, piercing hatred's heart, and he who was bound in chains was set free.
Which is very telling for stuff that happens.
Yeah, but it's also set up. Something I really like about this prophecy is it's set up in such a way that you can understand why the people who misinterpret it did so,
mm-hmm.
which I liked. I like that for once it's not just, you know, hubris, sure, but it sounds like it could mean that. So, yeah, it is really interesting.
And I mean, you do see some interesting things with this. Just because you see the cathedral light takes it, you know, in one very specific way. And you see Lilith's followers taking it in almost the opposite way, except they're both reading the same words. They're both reading what they want.
And true to Rathma's person, neither of them are right, neither of them are wrong. It's really interesting. But like, yeah, that prophecy is so it's interesting. It's interesting that they present it to you. I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. There's a movie that I really like, and I know both of you have seen it, the original Thing. And at the beginning of the movie, if you speak...
Wait, the 50s one?
Not the original, the remake from the 80s.
You confused me. I'm like, really? That doesn't sound like a movie you'd be all that into.
If you speak Swedish, they tell you how the movie ends in the first 10 minutes. And it's an interesting cinema fact, but like Diablo's sort of doing the same thing. Like, it's laying the path with this prophecy in the first 20 minutes of gameplay, 30 minutes of gameplay, like, or hour. I forgot how long it took to get there. Right. They're laying down how this game is going to play out before you even start really playing the game. And one, that's ballsy AF. And two, I think it's well done because, like Matt pointed out, it can be interpreted so many different ways. But as you progress through the various acts and the chapters of this particular story, you start to see what it actually means and how it unfolds. And there are these revelation moments where I don't know about you two, but like I'm sitting there like, oh yeah, okay. Oh, that's going to be horrible later. Awesome.
Act two, in my opinion, was the one where it managed to blindside me and I saw it coming at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just one of those things, but we should talk about
Act 1. Yeah, let's talk about Act 1. So Act 1, Lorath basically says, come follow me. We're going to go and we're going to go talk with the Church of Light. And we're going to do it because they might make useful allies. I don't actually believe that they can be trusted. So keep your wits about you. But we could probably at least use them.
He also immediately ditches you at the beginning of the act.
100%.
He's going off to do something else. You take care of this random stranger I met in a blizzard.
Yeah, before there's one moment here that I think it really sums up Lorath. Not only does he ditch you, he makes you go buy back his pole arm.
Yeah.
And you know, that he pawned off probably for booze money. He makes you get it back for him. And you go and you're like, hey, Lorath says he wants this thing back. He goes, great, you'll have to pay for it. The game doesn't charge you a lot of money, but it's just the sheer hubris of this man. He's just met you and he's like, yeah, go fetch my stick.
I mean, you get some really character defining moments for Lorath right here in the beginning. When you first walk into Kyovashad with Lorath, There is, they want you to do a cleansing ritual where you write the name of your biggest sin on like a piece of cedar and you burn the piece of cedar. And now a great weight has been lifted from your shoulders. And you walk into the gate and Lorath is like, yeah, they do this stupid ritual, whatever. And he like walks on through. He's like, no, I don't have time for this. And but the guard at the gate makes you do it. And then you do it, you walk inside, you go find Lorath. And Lorath, like, no matter what you write on that piece of wood, Lorath guesses what it is. You know, he's like, ah, whatever. But he guesses. You've got this look at Lorath as someone who is very perceptive, but mm-hmm. then immediately he does that thing Matt was talking about where he sends you off to buy his weapon. He doesn't even think. He has no, like, personal consideration for other people. He's like, yeah, go get my weapon, whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, you know, we're on a mission from God thing from the Blues Brothers, but in a, you know, in a Diablo way, but very much that he's so focused on, even when he went up to the mountain and, you know, was hiding from the world, he still is that person who just, there's a note on his table when you get in there and it's like, they've recently been converted, short fangs. And it's like, you realize he's talking about vampires.
Mm-hmm.
But he's just casually writing about, you know, some vampires he dissected while he's out in the woods, like he's going camping. And so, yeah, like Liz points out, he just takes off. He goes, he wants to know who the Pale Man is. And we should talk about that really fast. The Pale Man is Lilith's confederate, who you've seen briefly. If you watch the original cinematic from 2019.
Or the intro cinematic as you start the game up.
Yeah. It's the intro from... Then it's still there, but he's also there in the cinematic that Joe was talking about in the church, because he comes in and he's like, "Yes, Mother," and everyone's
that would be in the prologue. So you first kind of you see him in the intro cinematic, and then you see him again there helping Lilith in both cases.
Yeah, and the when you described him to Lorath, he was like, "I got to go," and he immediately takes off, which you know comes up later. He mentions another Haradrim that you could possibly go talk to. That's in Act 2. And then he says, but you should go to the church, like Liz said. I honestly felt like the church was fascinatingly creepy.
Yeah, very much so.
Liz mentioned the carpeting, if you want to talk about that again.
Yeah, talk about the carpet.
Well, the thing that it told you about them. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the environmental design in the world is really amazing, and there is detail. When you walk into the Cathedral of Light in Kyovashad, there's a red carpet, you know, going up to the altar with, like, gold embroidery, and you can tell in Kyovashad it's perfectly clean, it's not entirely unwrinkled, but it's mostly neat and orderly kind of in this main cathedral. But if you go to kind of what is more of a stronghold in Cor Valar, you see the carpet up at the entry. It's the same carpet, but it's covered in mud from people tromping it out. There's a war table inside, and you can tell knights have been tromping it out. The carpet is wrinkled, and it's covered in mud and footsteps. I mean, you get this sense of place just by looking around at the world, and there are a lot of little details that you see everywhere, and sometimes when you start thinking about them, they're really horrifying.
Yeah, and I think that right there is an interesting point, because I think... To me, this is where Act 1 really starts to show you how the world works and what the place mm-hmm. of everything is in it, right? And I think that's one of the most important things. Like, you're talking about the cathedral. Go ahead. Sorry.
I want to jump in with one tiny thing that I don't know if y'all have noticed. You can play through the first three acts in any order you like.
Yes,
mm-hmm, I did.
You could go straight to Act 3 and then do Act 2 and then do Act 1. You could do them complete in reverse order if you wanted to.
Yeah,
what's really interesting is if you talk to people, like, because I've done it on two different characters. On the first one, I went Act 1, Act 3, Act 2. And the mm-hmm. second one, I went Act 1, Act 2 for most of it, then stopped at a certain point and did some of Act 3, and then went back to Act 2. And when you talk to people, like when you talk to Prava, that you've seen Dornan, but before the really bad thing happens to Dornan, she just goes, yes, yes, just blows it off. But she does respond. There's extra dialogue where you can tell her that you spoke to him. Or if you talk to Lorath after the bad thing happens, he's like, yeah, it's horrible. And the dialogue changes depending on how far along you are in the other acts.
Mm-hmm.
So really well done. That is actually one of the things I noticed pretty soon, pretty early in my gameplay, I was like, whoa, okay, that was interesting. I got to see if that happens in another playthrough.
I will say one thing to pay attention to as you're playing through the game. Once you finish the game, you can go back to these places you started in, and people will have some very different responses for you.
Mm-hmm.
Just not even important story stuff, but like NPC chat, you can tell, okay, something has happened here and the world has changed. And that happens throughout the game. If a big story beat happens, you can go back and see things are different. NPCs have a different view of the world. Different things are happening in the world.
Yeah, I think in Act 1, a really good example of that is when you go, when you follow the first thread of everything and you end up going underground. We should just give that up.
Go for it. Yeah.
Basically, what happens is you go to talk to the Cathedral of Light, to the Reverend Mother Prava, who's... She's so hardcore believer that she has her scalp tattooed. You know, this woman's serious. And you hear about how Inarius cured her when she was a sick child. And you know, she tells about, you know, her faith. And she's very, very she's very, very big on faith. Faith is very important to her. You go there and she says, you know, we got this message. I was going to send Lorath to check it out, but I guess I'll send you since he didn't show. And your buddy Yosef, the guy that like clubbed a dude for you, is really mad that Lorath didn't show up.
You get the impression that he doesn't like Lorath.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. I mean, if you're a functionary in a church, I can't imagine anybody who'd bug you more than Lorath. But yeah, so they basically send you to like go look up this mine. It's close to where you were to Nevesk. It's like one town. It's like one little hamlet over, and go check that out and see what's going on. You go down, you meet up with this little girl who's like been, not really the little girl, I don't know how old she's supposed to be, like 15, 12?
I would say a teenager.
Yeah. I don't know
when they keep calling her a child, but she's got to be a teenager at least.
Yeah. Definitely didn't feel like a small child. But she shows up. Her name's Nayrel. She's coming back in later, so you should probably try to remember her. She's like,
important.
You know, yeah, you let my mother through, so, you know, you aren't you responsible for her? And it comes out that the guy in question, his name's Vigo, took a bribe to let her pass. And it wasn't even a good bribe.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad bribe. It's like a lucky charm. It's like
like a necklace or something. She gave him like, you know, just a she gave him like a knickknack, and he was okay.
We should point out that the mines they're going into has been closed on the orders of Reverend Mother Prava herself. No one is supposed to come or go.
Yeah, and we find out why. Do you want to go from here, Liz?
Please.
Okay. I mean, as the necromancer of the group, this is kind of my my moment. Except one thing that really disappoints me is that necromancers have, like, no special dialogue here. Like, nothing. It's very sad. But you go down, you go through the mines, but under the mines, there are some ruins, some very old ruins. You're going into the Necropolis of the Firstborn, which does seem to be exactly what the name suggests. It looks like a tomb for ancient Nephilim. And as you go through, you see these visions of Lilith. Lilith has been going through ahead of you, looking for Rathma, the first of her children. And you go through chasing Lilith. You meet some. Should we go straight to the end? Do we need to talk about the middle here, where you're running around, going back and forth? I think
we can go straight to the end.
So this happens, that happens, and you finally get to the into this kind of the heart of the Necropolis, and you see Rathma dead on the ground. Because Inarius, okay, we've got the Rathmus prophecy where he talks. It starts out, "I saw my corpse, I saw my corpse, and from my mouth crawled hatred." So yes, you go in, and there is Rathmus' corpse, and you see Lilith coming, and he's already dead when Lilith gets there. Lilith comes and takes a key to hell off of his body. And you learn that actually Inarius killed him because Inarius wanted the key to hell. Because, of course, Inarius looked at this prophecy and reads it as about him. He is the one who is going to have a spear of light that will pierce hatred's heart, which he reads as Lilith. He is going to kill Lilith, and in so doing, be redeemed to the heavens. He will get to go home. And he's real focused on this. This is like his only interest in life, very clearly.
And because we, and for context, if you haven't listened to our previous episodes of Diablo Lore, one, what are you doing? Go ahead and do that. Two, it's because he was essentially banished, right? He was given up as part of like a deal to sort of like keep things copacetic. Isn't really the right word, but to keep things from escalating further. He was given over.
Let me do a real quick recap of the two.
Lilith,
as we've mentioned, is Mephisto's daughter, the daughter of hatred. Inarius was not a member of the Injurious Council, but an archangel who was, you know, supporting them and, you know, advising them. He got really tired of the eternal conflict, which is the war between the angels and demons. You don't want me to try and recap that whole thing, but he was pretty fed up and he wanted it to end, but he had no idea how. He got captured by a couple of demons, but Lilith saved him before they could kill him because she had a plan. And she was also sick of the eternal conflict. So the two of them basically got together with this scheme where they went and recruited other members of various angels and demons to join them in their little act of rebellion. And they went to the Pandemonium Fortress, which is where most of the eternal conflict was being waged, because there was an artifact in it called the Worldstone or the Eye of Anu. And the Worldstone was called the Worldstone because it could literally make worlds. But usually what they do is they'd make a world with the Worldstone and it would fall apart as soon as someone stopped concentrating on it. But Lilith had an idea, and Inarius linked to the Worldstone, and the two of them, they stole the Worldstone by creating Sanctuary. That's why they keep calling Lilith the mother of Sanctuary in this game. It's quite literal. It's not just that she is the mother of humanity, essentially. She's literally the mother of Sanctuary. The world wouldn't exist if she hadn't come up with the idea. So they made the world and took the Worldstone into it, which apparently somehow affected it. Like, we don't know if it's because the Worldstone was inside of it or because there were thinking beings inside of it.
Or because it was a creation of two halves of the original divine entity that willed it into existence.
Yeah, we don't know. But we do know that this is the one world that someone made with the Worldstone, and it kept going. So they made Sanctuary, and they tried to hide from the eternal conflict. And apparently Lilith and Inarius were a lot closer back then, because Lilith got Inarius to help her conceive a child in the way that you think people do, except it was an angel and a demon, so I'm not sure what was going on, but nevertheless, they had Rathma, who at the time was named Lunarian, and he was the first of the Nephilim. The other Nephilim, we don't know who their parents were. Like, we know that there was Fiacla Gyar, Bulkathos, Eshu, and others. We don't know how they came to be. Like, we don't know if they were also Lilith's children, like if Inarius and Lilith had multiple children, or if the other angels and demons also had children. It's implied that the other angels and demons also had children, and that's where the first generation of Nephilim come from. Not just Lilith and Inarius, but Lilith and Inarius was the first, and obviously plays an incredible, important role in this game. But as Liz says, Inarius is so up his own butt. As Lorath put it, Lorath once said it really well. He's like, well, it turns out that being tormented in hell for thousands of years turns you into an arse.
Yep.
And that's Inarius. He is such, when he talks to your character, he basically just no-sells you. Like, he just does not care what you have to say. He doesn't care that you're looking to stop Lilith, because he figures, oh, I'm just going to go to hell and kill her. I don't have to care about this.
He's so tied into the prophecy. He fully believes the prophecy. He fully believes the prophecy is about him and Lilith, that it's like, it doesn't even matter what you're doing. It doesn't matter that you're chasing Lilith. It doesn't matter that you're asking for his help in something that he would conceivably like to have done, because, hey, there's this prophecy. The prophecy's going to happen. I'm just going to sit here and wait.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting, too, because Inarius isn't just a jerk, although he is absolutely a jerk. And Andy isn't just a person who kills his own son in a fit of pique.
Well, also because his son is decidedly neutral.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. His song that is like, you know, that is an important thing to hear. Rathma being the, you know, first of the necromancer, in being trained by, essentially it was Tra'Ghul, right?
Yep.
Being trained by Tra'Ghul is an agent of balance, is an agent of neutrality. There is no picking a side. And so that kind of is not exactly good when you have Anarius, who is just like, yeah, but we're going to go, I'm going to go back to heaven. I know what side of this battle I'm on. It sort of creates a little bit of friction with, you know, between father and son.
Just the best part of that whole exchange, which you see in flashbacks as you're running through trying to catch up to Lilith, who is, of course, already gone, is you see Anarius talking to Rathma and just keeps making demands. And Rathma keeps trying to explain to him, it's not how this works. Like, if you get the key, it's because you take it off my corpse, because that's how someone gets the key. You know, it is I die and then someone loots my body. You know, that is how this is going to work. So if you are going to get the key, it's because you take it off my corpse. And apparently Anarius was like, stabity then, because I want that key. And he didn't find
it. Also, yeah, that implies that he stabbed his son and then is like, okay, where's the key? And he's like looking for the key and he can't find it because he never gets the key. Lilith takes the key off of Rathma.
Yeah.
So it doesn't say much for his intelligence level. I mean, he's so focused on this. And one of the things he tells Rathma is that his fate is his own. But at the same time, he is so glued to this prophecy, even though, you know, he kind of missed a step there because he did not find the key to hell.
Somebody in the game later makes a good point about Anarius that I will try to bring up when we get there. But yeah, Anarius is very clearly not playing this game. Like, if you've played Diablo games before, the angel you're most familiar with is Tyriel. And Tyriel is kind of sets a high standard for what angels are like. Anarius does not meet it.
No, not even close.
I mean, we've met some other angels and they're kind of, most of them are jerks. And sometimes calling them jerks is like kind of underselling, because angels don't really, they aren't really interested in humanity any more than demons are. They aren't interested in helping
They're significantly less interested in humans than demons are. Because demons are like, ooh, soul food and stuff we can use to fight things. And the angels are like, just burn them. Just burn them all. It's disgusting. They're horrible monsters. Kill them. So yeah, it's kind of, Tyriel was like the best angel, it turned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by a long shot.
So yeah, you basically go through Act 1 trying to catch up to Lilith. Also doing a whole lot of quests in the Fractured Peaks, because, man, there's a lot of quests in the Fractured Peaks. And it's like... go ahead.
I want to jump in here with a tiny thing, and you actually brought this up in chat the other day, is how big Sanctuary is. Mm-hmm. How big of a game Diablo 4 is compared to the previous games. Just the landmass you have to explore, and the game really encourages you to explore with all the side quests and little hidden things. The map is huge. There are so many places to go. And if you just follow the main story, you are just seeing a tiny bit of it. This place is vast, and the amount of story in it is also vast.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Joe said just before we started recording, I think he was talking about, if you stop and follow like one of the quests, like you take the first part and then like just follow it and keep doing it, you will like find yourself 10 quests deep in this really complicated story that is really not related to Lilith and her thing at all. It's just, it's like there's one guy when you leave Kyovashed to get to River Mother Prava, because you need to get a blessing in order to cross the Black Lake. There's the usual role playing stuff where you gotta get a thing to do a thing. But you're on your way north and you see a guy at the side of the road and he's just kind of like ranting, and you're like, what, you okay? And he's like, no, my dead son keeps coming. They took him to the asylum for his crimes. Now he won't leave me be. So, you know, you being you, you're like, all right, sure. The asylum full of crazy people.
That's also a quest that as you play through it, it gets worse. It starts out with this father being haunted by his son. And you literally see the ghost of his son standing right there. Father, won't you come and visit me? Please come
and visit me. At the Black Asylum? But yeah, with a name like that, I'll be there tomorrow. But yeah, you get there, and I'm just going to tell you guys what happens.
Yeah.
You get there, and it turns out that the kid's like, he lied. And he's, you have to put him down because, you know, ghost. But you get that done. You're like, I'm got a bad feeling about this. And you go back to the guy who's also the voice actor is Simon Templeton.
Let me interrupt you for just a second there. If you go through and explore the entire dungeon, you see there's a journal or something you can find where they talk about, okay, where the asylum is closing. So let's just go out and lock the doors and these animals can just fend for themselves. And you can see in the environment there that it's like they've left all of the prisoners, all of the people in the asylum have just been left to starve to death.
Yeah,
locked which is like up, and one all of the worst of the ways imaginable. Left, lock yeah. the doors. Mm-hmm. It's terrible. And so, surprise, there are a lot of angry ghosts. Tons. Oh, yeah. So many. Yeah.
But so when you finally get back after going to the incredibly happy Black Asylum, I don't know why we don't go there every day. You get back to the guy and he's like, but my guild continues. You know, after he's like, I killed your son's ghost. So I guess I killed him again. He's like, but my guilt continues. I still hear him calling me because I'm the one who committed the crimes he went to the asylum for. I let my son die. It's like basically this guy framed his kid for like probably something really, really bad.
That's not actually how I read it, but.
Oh, that's how I read it. Because he says he was there for my crimes. He says that.
I mean, I took it a different way.
You can take it different ways too, which is happens in a lot of these quests. But whatever, he goes off to go to the asylum, which is certainly going to lead to his death. There's no chance he's living through this experience. He is going to die in there because all those ghosts are going to come out and rip him into little pieces. And you're like, okay, I guess. Well, thanks for the quest reward before you do that. Wow. Okay, well, I'm sure that when I go down to the hollowed ossuary, that won't be depressing. Oh my God. And it is amazing how this game manages to not be depressing.
I should note that so it's like you meet the guy and his son, and then it's like you carry on down the road, and then you get a quest from a dying knight to go to the hollowed ossuary, which, yes, is also a terrible place.
Yeah,
and you just keep sending these breadcrumbs to terrible things that can completely pull you off of the main story.
Yeah, and the Fractured Peaks is not unique here. But I think Act One does an amazing job of setting up what you are going to be experiencing in this game. You're going to be heroic. You know, you're going to be the hero of the story, but there's absolutely going to be a ton of awful stuff. And it's sort of, I said before about that idea of, you know, good people trying to do the right thing.
Even if it's not just good people doing the right thing, it's people trying to survive. And I think that's what the Act One does a really good job of setting up in general. Like, we really haven't gone into it, and we're going to be running out of time because there's so much to this game. We're going to have to do multiple episodes.
Hope you don't have your weekends planned, Liz.
The idea, though, that, like, why people are joining these cults or why people are susceptible to Lilith's message, right? Because that's the thing that I think is really portrayed early on is, yeah, humanity has been used to fighting against the greater evils, the lesser evils, demons and things like that. But when Lilith pops up, Lilith doesn't have that same fear factor. She does initially, like, people will recoil and maybe run away, but her message is trying to get humanity to almost raise up and take back sanctuary.
Yeah, the line in the prophecy that Liz read, you know, the sheep, lambs will become wolves.
Yeah.
She uses it quite skillfully.
And who, if you're in that, if you're living in that world, you're living in these like pockets of humanity where like literally 10 feet outside your gate, if you open it, there could be a mass of Wendigos just ready to just eat your face. You know, why wouldn't that be a message that you would latch on to? And like going back to what Liz and Matt were talking about, that this game isn't depressing. It is depressing, but it's overshadowed by people latching on to hope. And Lilith's message is one shrouded in hope for the average person. If I give into these sins, if I unlock the power that's within me, I don't have to live in fear anymore. I don't have to worry about the monsters beating down the door because I'm the monster staring back at them. And it becomes
There's actually an interesting thing here, too. I think that you guys will both probably have noticed this, but in a very real way, the Cathedral of Light that we see in this game, it's not the Zakharum Church.
No.
You will see Zakharum later.
Yes.
But the Cathedral of Light is Inarius's exact inversion of what Lilith is doing.
Yes, I was just going to get there. Please, go ahead. Explain why.
Well, basically, like, the Lilith's doctrine, and we can talk about how she does or doesn't live up to it, but her doctrine is one where the strong must be allowed to be as strong as they can be to defeat hell. This must be, like, a personal empowerment thing. Like, seriously, that is her message, is personal empowerment, no matter what. Like, if you have to kill people, do it. Whatever you have to do to get as powerful as you can, because, this thing is coming. The Lords of Hell are coming. Meanwhile, Inarius is like, you can't be trusted to wipe your own butt. Your people are weak and foolish, and you should just listen to me and do what I tell you, because that's the only way you're getting through this. You're just, look at you. You're just constantly sinning. You're just awful. And that's like, that cinematic from the very beginning in the prologue, it's of a Cathedral of Light priest who is berating the people of the town for sinning. And they're all sitting there in the pews like, oh, here we go again. And then when Lilith shows up, at first everyone's terrified, but then she starts talking and it's like, yeah, we are beautiful. F that guy. And things fall apart for him after.
And one thing, you never see Lilith directly herself doing acts of violence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lilith is always calm and collected, and she's just out here speaking the truth. She wants to empower humanity to fight the Lords of Hell. And that's another counter with Inarius, who, like, when you go to talk to Inarius, it's like he's very terse with you, and he just kind of turns around and says, this is concluded. This conversation is concluded. And he doesn't talk to you anymore. And you go, when you return from that conversation, talk to Prava, she's like, oh, well, I know his ways. That means he approves of you because you're still here and you're alive, which sort of suggests that people go to Inarius for help or advice or a conversation, and he just kills them.
Yeah.
Or injures them or maims them. There's
Which coincides with the lore, because who was one of the ones that wanted to vote to kill all of humanity and all the Nephilim? Inarius.
Well, No, technically speaking, he didn't. It's kind of more like he was the one saying, let's all calm down. Let's take a step. Let's relax. I feel like tempers are getting, Lilith, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just killing everybody. It's like that scene where, the kid's running and they're like, hey, what are you doing? What are you running with? A knife. It's like that, except Lilith was killing all the angels and demons that wanted to kill the Nephilim. But yeah, you're totally dead on that. And Inarius, well, let's talk about Viggo really fast before we run out of time. In that scene, that when you are trying to figure out what's going on and you are trying to get the Cathedral of Light to do anything useful, you keep running into that Viggo guy that took the bribe to let the woman and Lilith through. And
it's pretty clear as you go that he's in trouble with the church. This is like a big sin. This is a big problem. And he's really anxious about it. Not in part because, okay, he's probably going to lose his job over this, and Sanctuary isn't a great place. Probably not a good place to go without having a regular salary. But also he feels really guilty because Knights died because he let Lilith and Nyrell's mother into this mine.
And also beyond that, he's a pale knight, which are servants of Inarius.
Yeah. Yeah. He believes this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's one point where you find him praying and even says, yeah, so what if I like to gamble? It doesn't make me a sinner. And it's like, you get this real glimpse. In a lesser game, he would have been disposable. Mm-hmm. He would have been just some guy who does a dumb thing. But you get to see him living with what he's done. You get to see the other knights, and not all the knights. Some of the knights are really mad at him, but some of them are like sympathetic to him. Like the door guard, when you get to the cathedral, the door guard says, "Viggo, good luck." And you get a lot of that kind of. It's like it's little bits. They don't spend all their time on it, but it's there.
I mean, there's some nuance in that. When you first meet Viggo, it's like, ugh, this jerk. He just took a bribe, and now he doesn't want to help us. And you kind of get halfway through the mine, and things are looking bad. And he's like, I gotta go. This is really bad, and I have to leave and get some more knights. And Prava will know what to do. Sorry, you're on your own. And you're kind of like, man, this guy is a huge jerk. He only cares about his skin and his job, and he's just, he bailed on us. But as you keep going through, you see these little moments with him where it's like he feels really guilty about the knights who died down there on his watch because he let these people through. He feels really bad and he wants to make amends. And it's kind of, he wants to make amends so badly that things go very badly for him.
Yeah, I will say that to me, the message of the show, the symmetry of these two characters that are driving this plot is revealed when you see, while you are fighting to get past this tomb guardian that Lilith has left behind, and she's clearly left it behind. Once you actually get in there, she's left it behind because that's her son's body in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even, she didn't leave it behind because, you know, to stop you or delay you. She's literally, that's her son's body. And she clearly has feelings about that. Liz pointed that out. Actually, I had missed it the first time.
Oh, what she says when she's like observing the corpse, when she comes upon it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good, Liz.
Yeah, I mean, I think the demon is even named Lilith's Lament or something of that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Title.
Mm-hmm. So you go in there and like suddenly this big, what looks like almost a robot shows up, and it's even telegraphed a bit. They do a little bit of like, you know, setting it up when you're like going to see Prava, and you can stop and ask a guy, what is with that giant suit of armor? He's like, this is no armor. It's a magic relic. Few people even understand how to make this work. And when that thing shows up and it helps you, it's like putting a barrier around you when the boss is doing evil things. And then once you get the boss down, you can lift the helmet thing, which is, first off, if you ever give your giant medieval magic robot the head from Silent Hill, like you made him pyramid head. That is not good. But when you lift it up, it's Viggo in there, and there's like spikes driven into his body. The thing is powered by his agony. Like, it's killing him. In fact, he dies. He dies because he put this thing on. And that's how Inarius treats his people.
It is also literally, like, you can see the armor is completely full of blood. Viggo is inside the armor in just a massive pool of blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and it's, that's Inarius. That's how he views people.
I want to pose something here. Oh, go ahead.
One thing I think is interesting, and maybe y'all will have more context on this, is the power of blood, this blood magic that seems to carry through the game. So, if you go on.
I was going to say, I have an interesting theory about that, and I was going to pose this as a question for you two, particularly Liz, because you've played more of the game at this point than we have. Also, by the time we do our second recording, Matt and I should be done with the story in theory. But there seems to be finally an inkling of what Lilith's sort of purview is as far as demons go, because we know that demons, at least the greater and lesser demons, all share like an aspect of sin or an aspect of some great evil, whether it's terror, hatred, whatever the case is, but they're all like extreme versions of sort of that distilled idea. Lilith almost seems like she is a distilled representation of love through blood. And what I mean by that is sort of like she feels so keenly attached to that which is essentially her own that she will do whatever to protect it in such an extreme manner that is sort of like her aspect. Like there's this old philosophical question, and Matt may remember who said it. I can't remember who off the top of my head, but there was this whole debate of, is love a sin? And I think Lilith, in her representation in this game, is sort of starting to answer that question. And
it was Tertullian, by the way.
Thank you. See, I knew
it. Church Tertullian.
I knew he would know.
He argued that it was.
Yeah, but I feel that's interesting here because of how the light is portraying her, how the light the Church of Light views her. Like when you deal with Prava and you talk with Prava about it, the reaction, the visceral reaction to it, when you see the cultists of Lilith, the ones that she's touched, how they react to it. And going back to what Liz was talking about, that scene where she comes across Rathma's body, like you feel sort of keenly this, like she does legitimately feel connected to humanity and the Nephilim. And what aspect that takes and how that evolves throughout the game sort of like informs what she is technically an aspect of. And I think that's represented through like the blood magic, which is a central theme of the game. Blood petals of Lilith, the blood magic, finding the fonts of blood. If you look at the demons that are actually coming into the world as a game mechanic, they're not born through hellfire. They're born through sigils of blood, like, which is absolutely fascinating to me. And I think, I don't know if that's something you guys picked up on, but there's almost a squelchy nature when a demon comes into the world.
Well, I mean, go ahead.
The thing I think is really interesting is you see this blood magic used by both sides. So yeah. When Lilith is working her way into this temple, it's like she's doing a ritual to cross the lake and get into the necropolis of the firstborn. And she says, blood is the key. There are these runes written out in blood. There's like a dead priest before you get there, so they could have blood to make the runes to cross the lake. But you also see the Cathedral of Light using blood in the same way. This suit that Viggo was wearing with the spikes in it, if you talk to someone about it, it's like it's powered by faith, is what he says. It's powered by faith. It's not moved by the body, but by faith. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't know if that's faith. That is blood. That is, you know, it's this power in blood. And if you look at the iconography in the cathedral, this is more of those game details, you see art pretty regularly of a woman holding a chalice of blood with a drop of blood floating over it. Well, right in front of the big Cathedral of Light, it's, you know, a big, you know, kind of starburst thing in the floor, but it has a drop of blood in the middle.
Yeah.
There's also a side quest in Kyovashad you can do.
Yeah, the one with the confessor. Yeah, the exorcist.
Sister Octavia. Yes.
Yeah, she's an exorcist.
Yes, and you can go through and help her, and she's doing this ritual, and it involves cutting her hand and putting blood into a chalice to exorcise demons.
Yeah, and notice like, that she calls out to Inarius to purify her blood when she's using it. And that's what I think is interesting.
Well,
blood magic goes back all the way.
I was going to say real quick, don't forget how the game starts. The game starts by using blood of three willing or close enough to willing participants to summon Lilith back from the void.
Yes, blood is literally the key. Yes. I mean, that's exactly what they say back in that very first cinematic. Blood is the key. Blood was the key to opening the door, and it was also the key to summoning Lilith. They needed the blood of the willing. And you see three people went into that tomb, and all three of them were sacrificed in order to bring Lilith into being. Blood is the key, and you see that over and over again, but not just from the demons. You see that in the cathedral as well.
Well, I mean, I think that goes back to the origins of humanity in the first place in the game, because humans are born out of the mixture of angelic and demonic. They have both. Mm-hmm. That's how Malthiel almost killed humanity. He killed 90% of us by exploiting that, by trying to pull the demon out of people with the Black Soul Stone. And of course, you pull half of a person's soul out, they die. But that blood, the blood contains power because it contains both angelic and demonic. The original Church of Zacharum used to say all the time, the light is in you. It doesn't come from somebody else. It's inborn. It's in you. And you see blood magic. There's blood magic in Diablo 2. Like the Countess shows up in Kandurus.
Yeah.
She's doing blood magic.
Yeah.
And it's like, look at all the torture devices in the old monastery. They were doing blood magic. And you see that there's like, it is really fascinating to think about how this all ties into that whole idea of Lilith's way to win the war was to create the Nephilim.
But it makes sense, though, when you consider how, well, again, the origins of angels and demons, when they derive themselves from Anu or Tathamet, the Diamond Warrior or Tathamet, where Anu was the first entity that was originally the combination of both of them. Humanity or the Nephilim are the closest thing to Anu in existence.
Yeah, the recombination of the once together, now separate things. It's actually also really interesting to see how Lilith seems to have genuine emotions about some things, but she's also astonishingly cold-blooded.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we didn't really even get to Act 2. We're definitely going to have to do another show, man, because we're still on Act 1.
There's There's so much here, right? Like, and that's one of the more fascinating things about Diablo 4, and is just that how much story is actually being thrown into it. Not to like put it too fine of a point on it, but when you compare it to Diablo 1, Diablo 2, and Diablo 3, like while Diablo 3 had more story than the other ones, and Diablo 2 had more story than Diablo 1, this is the most concentrated set of story that we've ever received in game. In fact, most of Diablo's 2 story came from the Sin War books and the books that were released after the game was out. Diablo 3, a lot of the stuff that was not contained in the game was done through like the Book of Cain and a lot of other publication that was done outside, whether it was comics or anything else. And there were Diablo comics. There absolutely were. Here, Diablo 4 is almost doing kind of the thing that we, at least on the show, talk about a lot, which is bringing all of that story into a playable experience for players, which makes the game feel more robust, more immersive as far as the world goes. It still has that core gameplay loop of beat up the bad guy, get the cool shiny object, wear the cool shiny object till you beat up the next bad guy and get the next shiny object. That gameplay loop is still there, but while you're doing it, you're helping the scared ghost that's trying to find its resting place while things are trying to consume its essence. Or
did you guys, I'm sorry to break in, but did you guys go to Northern Skosglen?
You know, maybe. I don't think I did.
Did you find the town with like all the walking corpses around?
Oh, yes.
The wet town where everybody gets drowned.
Yeah.
Did you love that?
I don't remember that. There's another town like that later that has a bunch of drowned around it, but it's definitely later.
Yeah. When you go to Northern Skosglen, there's the town that I think it's the same town, maybe just different quests, but there's a whole big story about this, which turns out to basically be a metaphor of this woman who's just furious with her mother because her mother turned into a monster essentially. And you're sitting there going, wow, yet more convoluted, you know, parent-child relationships, Diablo 4, huh? You going there? There's like, these stories could be the heart of a different game. Like, just this side quest could be a whole game about how, you know, you're fighting these, like, you know, aquatic corpses who are people being tempted into, you know, succumbing to the Leshy's influence, blah, blah. And I'm sitting going, they did this in like five quests, five astonishingly fraught quests. And in the end, it has as close to a happy ending as Diablo 4 gets, in that you successfully destroy the thing, and now this woman has to live with the fact that she hates her mother. Mm-hmm. And now is like, you know, I've done it, I've destroyed her, but that was my mother. And it's just like this moment of, you know, this is what, even if you're a good person, or even if you're not a good person, but you're just a person, somebody who's just like living on a farm, living their life, these events happened that just destroyed everything. And the world is bleeding. Sanctuary is bleeding. So in a way, maybe Lilith is right. Although she does things when you get through those quests and you're like, oh my God. But the points she makes are valid. She doesn't lie. She manipulates people by not lying to them. She's kind of like Zoltan Kuhl on crack. Because remember how Zoltan Kuhl never lied to you? He was always telling you the truth, even though he was obviously spinning it. Lilith just looks and goes amateur and just, you know, just starts talking. And by the end of it, you're like, yeah, and Arius did do that to us. Like, and it's astonishing to watch.
Yeah, she's very smooth about it. She never appears to lie to you. And she makes everything she says sound very convincing. And in many ways, she's right, because we know that the Lords of Hell want to destroy Sanctuary. We know that the angels don't care. The angels are not going to be there to protect us. We have to fend for ourselves. We have to be strong enough to fend for ourselves. She makes really good points. Is this the right way to become strong enough to fend for ourselves? I don't know, but I also don't know how we're going to fend off the Lords of Hell, because we've never managed to do it.
Yeah, even Lorath admits that evil doesn't get beat, really, in this setting. It just, you can do whatever you want. You can put them in whatever soulstone you want. They're going to come back. You just have to accept it.
And there's definitely some interesting implications of that as we're going to move later on. And the next episode, I hope we can get to through Acts 2, 3, and 4, because there's some really good stuff there. Although 2 does feel like you can get through it a little bit faster than 1. One feels like it is exceptionally robust for the sheer purpose of world building, which I'm grateful for, actually. But yeah, so I think that's going to do it, unless there's anything else you guys want to add in for the epilogue or act one right now. All right, well then, folks, Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means that this podcast signing community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to this podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. We do want to thank you for joining us on this episode. If you have questions for this or any of our podcasts, be sure to send those into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify what show it's for in the subject line so that we can make sure that they get to the right place. If you want to hit us up on Discord, we have two channels set aside. One for our everyday supporters, the ones that aren't supporting us on Patreon. You can just send us in at the Patreon Q&A podcast questions. If you are supporting us on Patreon, you can also hit us up on our Patreon Q&A podcast questions channel, where we tend to look for our questions and themes first as a way of saying thank you to our Patreon supporters for helping us keep the lights on. But with that, folks, we'll see you next week.